I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has not gotten out much since the civil war against him started 4 years ago. No foreign trips for him. Then last night, Assad popped up in Russia. He was in Moscow for a quick visit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's understandable. Russian warplanes have been pounding Assad's opponents hard for the past 3 weeks. And the Kremlin says the two leaders discussed the military situation, but also the need for a political settlement. I asked Neil McFarquhar for his take on all this. He's Moscow bureau chief for The New York Times.
Well, obviously, the Kremlin has done Mr. Assad a huge service since he was sinking, and it looked like he was gradually losing his grip on the country, and the Russian military intervention has completely, or, you know, at least for the moment, reversed his fortunes because the military is back on the initiative. And Mr. Putin clearly wants to exploit the gains that he feels he's made. And the Kremlin made it clear in their announcement that he was the one who called the meeting and asked Mr. Assad to come to Moscow, which obviously, since Russia is his savior at the moment, he could hardly refuse.
Yeah, what can we learn from that kind of power statement? We summoned him. He didn't come here on his own volition.
Well, I think that, you know, Russia has various goals in its Syrian enterprise. First of all, there is a legitimate concern about spread of terrorism and the possible collapse of yet another state in the Middle East. And secondly, Mr. Putin would like to present himself both to the world and domestically as a man who tackles and solves difficult problems. And so by having Mr. Assad come here, that presents him in that light.
So this talk of a political settlement for Syria, what clues have you picked up, Neil, about what that actually means, especially while Russian warplanes are bombing?
Well, in starting his intervention in Syria, Mr. Putin and senior Russian officials also have stressed that it is not only about taking on the Islamic State, but also a political transition. And in the quotes that the Kremlin put out today in the transcript, they had Putin saying that, you know, our position is that a positive result in military operations will lay the basis for working on a long-term settlement based on a political process that involves all political forces, ethnic and religious groups. I was quoting there. And Mr. Assad responded that, of course, we want a political transition, but the terrorism, and he lumps all the opposition against him as terrorists, that question, the terrorism question, has to be addressed first. And then, of course, everyone in Syria will want to be involved in the political transition. So on the face of it, it looks like that there is an agreement. But I think that no one quite knows how flexible Mr. Assad is on that point. And I think that Mr. Putin probably wanted to meet him just to sound him out, to find out what he meant by participation in a political transition.
Yeah, and I guess really hard to know what was discussed behind closed doors. But it sounds like Moscow is suggesting that, you know, long-term process for all the actors, that Assad is just another pawn in the game when it comes to a settlement. Is that the takeaway here?
You know, it's very difficult to assess because what Russian says, of course, is not always what it does. And also there are unknowns. I mean, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, was asked whether Mr. Assad's future was discussed, and he declined to comment. And I think for Russia, you know, bringing him here and making it a high profile visit, even after the fact, because they didn't announce it until after the meeting was over. But by giving him a high profile visit to the Kremlin, it's saying that we see Mr. Assad as the legitimate president of Syria. And, you know, they've been saying that for months, that he's the elected president, and it's not up to outsiders to change him. And basically, they want to avoid a Libya scenario where, you know, or an Iraq scenario where the head of state is removed by outsiders, not to mention the West, and then chaos and a vacuum ensues. So I think that's Russia's main goal. Now, they keep saying they're not married to Mr. Assad in that process, but they haven't really spelled out what they see as the steps in a political transition, other than to emphasize that it should be a Syrian-led process.
Neil McFarquhar with The New York Times speaking with me from Moscow. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anytime.
As you might imagine, things look a bit different in Syria, especially for those who still support President Assad.
And the sort of overarching reaction to Russia among supporters of the Syrian government is that Russia is going to save them. So not just that this is a meaningful intervention, but that this is a decisive intervention that will change everything and end the war.
That's correspondent Thanasi Kambanis. He was recently allowed to visit Syria by the Assad government, which also monitored his movements. Thanasi says the secular elite in Syria share a deep comfort level with the newly arrived Russian forces.
One of the scenes I witnessed was on a visit to the Ministry of Defense, and there was a couple of chunky guys who had, I picked up from chit-chat, had been all over the country in the last week, including to places like Palmyra, where ISIS is occupying the area. And finally I said, "What TV station do you guys work for?" And they laughed. They were from the Russian Ministry of Defense, and they'd been crisscrossing the country in the first week of the bombing. But there were you could see the Syrian officers who were interacting with them, who included a woman in uniform, by the way, which is not surprising in a place like the United States, but isn't necessarily what you'd expect in a regular Arab country. Mm. They seemed really all on the same page and like they were sort of rescuing something together.
So I gather some fans of the Syrian regime refer to Putin as Abu Ali.
Yeah, that's a...
What does that imply?
So the nickname for Putin, I mean, this Abu Ali is an affectionate sort of typical nickname in coastal Syria, is a way of saying, you know, this guy is going to be one of us. He's going to be the godfather of our victory. And he's a little bit of an old-fashioned strongman in their eyes.
You know, we get so rarely a sense of what life is like inside Damascus, the capital these days. Take us to one of the neighborhoods you spent time in, a place called Jadamana. What is it like and who lives there right now?
This is a suburb of Damascus that before the war had about 350,000 residents and then vast orchards and open green areas. Today, it's home to something like 1.7 million people from all over Syria, crowded in an unbelievably dense area. So even the old orchards have had six-story apartment buildings spring up. There's a lot of tension in there. And the local elders of Jaramana at the beginning of the uprising worked triple time to convince local resistance fighters to leave the neighborhood because they basically said, you know, we can't bear the brunt of fighting here. There's too many people, too much collateral damage. And they successfully either strong-armed or persuaded revolutionaries to move elsewhere. And today it's a place that feels actually stable but untenable.
Yeah. Now, you met several people in Jaramana. First of all, a government militiaman named Noor. He used to run a family store. What's his thinking now?
Well, he was a veteran of the fourth Division, which is one of the most loyal and trusted army divisions of the regime. He had retired, was, I think, selling clothes. And as soon as the war broke out, he was one of the first to volunteer to form a neighborhood watch militia. He's a Christian. He's a neighborhood man and a family man. And he is very, very determined to wipe out the people who have taken up arms against the government. He said, "I don't care what the president says about forgiveness. We're not going to forgive the people on the other side. And even if they seek forgiveness, we're never going to accept them to live amongst us. And it's better," he said, "to kill even some of our own supporters in the process if it means we get rid of all the opposition."
So a lot of support with the people you met for Bashar al-Assad. Of course, you were with a government minder. You did meet one couple, a pro-rebel wife and a pro-government husband. That's serious polarization, and not just at the level of James Carville and Mary Madeline. How does a couple like that stay together?
It's interesting because there's a lot of pain and a lot of anguish in their disagreement. I wrote about a scene over dinner where we could hear barrel bombings exploding in a nearby area of the capital, and the wife burst out crying. She was so moved and aggrieved by the sound of what was probably possibly dozens of people, innocent people dying. And that's what she said. She said, "People are dying." And her husband very calmly rebuked her, and he said, "Those aren't people. Those are just fighters." And apparently they have fights about this every day. And the way they manage it is they sort of limit the amount of time they spend fighting over it. And clearly they've chosen to stay together, and that's just one open wound in their family. And from what I gathered, it's very typical throughout the country where you'll have brothers fighting on both sides of the conflict or on three sides of the conflict from the same family.
Thanasi, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time today.
Good to talk to you, Marco.
Thanasi Kambanis is a columnist with the Boston Globe and the author of Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story.